welcome to another episode of Stuck in My Mind podcast. I am your host, W-I-Z-E. I am very excited. My next guest is a true AI aficionado. He's also the author of ChatGPT Profits. Welcome to the show, Jonathan Green.
Hey, hello. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Wow, the pleasure is all mine because AI is something I've been using within the last year or so. I'm excited to have this conversation with you. So let's just jump right into it. Okay, can you share your journey from the from being fired during the Blizzard to thriving as an online entrepreneur, and what role did AI play in that transformation?
Sure, my journey started 13 years ago when I thought I had my dream job, and it was a nightmare. You know, you get what you want, and you realize, wait, I'm 29, I'm done. I've reached the peak of my career. All I could do is wait for my boss to die and take over her job in 20 years, I guess, and I was depressed. So I thought it's my dream job, and I probably would have never quit. I was already thinking, how long do I have to stay until I pay off my student loan? How long do I have to stay to kind of get these things done? And I don't know if I ever would have quit. You know, I hated it, but I was kind of stuck there. So I got in this position. I was like, well, my parents love what I'm doing. Everyone thinks it's so cool and it sounds so great, but they fired me and I only was in there for a couple of weeks. And I was like, man, that's the best thing ever happened to me because they just set me free. I finally realized I got to take control of my destiny. So from there, I just began trying different online business models, trying to see what would work, and found something that worked and just stuck with it. And from there, I tried something else. And that's really part of it, is that your first idea is not going to be a winner, right? It's just not. Everyone thinks it is. It's like, man, I wish. Wasn't my first idea. Wasn't my second idea. Wasn't my third idea. So I tried a lot of different business models till I found the one that was right for me. And then just began to grow my business. And really, that all happened before AI was around. So okay. It's only in the past year that really AI has become a major part of my business, because you just want a situation where you learn what's going on, or you can let it run right over you, because AI is here to stay.
And a lot of people are very skeptic about AI. I'm not, me personally. I use Cast Magic. I use ChatGPT. I use Midjourney. I use a bunch of other ones. What kind of impact has AI really have on your business growth within this past year?
Sure. The biggest thing kind of impact AI has had is that it's kind of changed the way every company prices their products. So companies, when I started out 10 years ago, you bought a piece of software and you owned it, right? You bought something, even like Photoshop, or you bought all the whole suite of products from Adobe, like $650 or $1,000 or $2,000, which package you got, and then you just owned it, right? You didn't have to worry about whatever. He's like, okay, I paid the fee, this is mine for as long as I want it. And then they all switched to everything's a subscription. Microsoft Word, that's a monthly fee. You want to have Microsoft Word work on your computer and your phone? That's another monthly fee. And it suddenly became, it's this new business model where everyone just bleeds you like a death of a thousand cuts. And the biggest crazy thing is, like, tools like Jasper that were like the hot AI tool last year charge you per word. So every time you have AI generate an extra word, it costs you a credit, which costs you money. And once you go over that limit, we're charging you extra. And then ChatGPT comes along and is like, yeah, what do you charge? $20. How many words? Unlimited. And all these other companies now, if you go to Jasper's page now, man, their prices drop like 80%. I'm sure they've lost most of their customer base because people are like, wait, I can get something better for less money. Bye. I know I closed my account. A lot of other people did that have done the same. So what's happened is suddenly all these softwares that were monthly had prices in the hundreds of dollars have dropped and pushed it down to where you can get a lot of them for $20, $30, $40. And there are still some softwares that are trying to be more expensive, but it's really hard right now because it's like everyone just goes, well, this is ChatGPT is 10 times better than your tool. This is what it costs. So there's this downward pressure on pricing, which is really nice because a lot of companies are just, once they get a product people use, and they just put in some like really harsh pricing. It just really, you know, hits the customers too hard. So I think that it's been a really good thing in that way for me. And the second way it's been really good is I think that artificial intelligence is a great equalizer, right? Like anyone, anywhere can use AI for free. There's so much. You can use ChatGPT for free. You can use Claude for free. There's open source AIs that are beating paid AIs. So you don't have to. Yeah, if you do have the paid version of ChatGPT, $20 a month, you get some extra features. You don't need it. You could still do 80-90% of everything. So suddenly the bottom of the market's who's helped the most, because people that have a lot of money don't have time to learn all these tools, right? They can't figure out the complexity. But for someone who's like, you know, English is their second language, they're trying to write articles, make money, and they're always making mistakes in their English, so people don't pay them that much. That's gone. ChatGPT doesn't make mistakes in English. You can just run everything through ChatGPT now. Boom, your English is as good as everyone else. So suddenly the biggest hurdle has just been eliminated. The barrier that's kept out English as a second language, people from making the best money, that just got erased. The barriers that kept people out that like have certain abilities with graphics, it's gone with Midjourney. So the way it's really changed my life is that it's allowed me to get access to a lot more tools and a lot more affordable prices. We're growing my business a lot faster. It's allowed me to be a lot more agile. And it's allowed me to kind of carve out a space in the market where I can help other people understand what I'm doing, how I'm doing it, so that they can kind of replicate my success, because everyone knows they need AI. Most people are like, I don't know if AI, which AI is a good AI, which AI is a bad AI, which companies are pretending to have an AI. Because there's a lot of software out there that's not actually AI. They're just lying. They know their software is just worth more if they claim to be an AI company. So it's definitely a time where there's a lot of confusion, but also a lot of opportunity.
And why do you think people are still skeptical about using ChatGPT and other AIs?
Sure. So ChatGPT is the biggest and most powerful software I've ever used, with the worst onboarding I've ever seen from any company. Like, based on what the tool should be, how the power of ChatGPT, everyone should use it. Based on the onboarding, nobody should use it. It's like the owner sat down and said, listen, here's what we're going to do for the homepage. All right, how are we going to welcome people? What do we teach people? He goes, no, blank page. What do you mean blank page? Just blank white page. It should say nothing, just have a bar where they enter text. And how people know what ChatGPT does? Like, they're not going to know. It's going to be a surprise. And it's like such a crazy process. It tells you, like, if the software wasn't amazing, nobody would use it because it's so uncomfortable. And what's even crazier is Perplexity, really cool AI account, said, you know what? We'll do blank page too. And then Claude was like, yeah, okay, blank page sounds good. They all kind of agreed to give the users a really bad experience. When you sign up for an AI, there's no welcome email that kind of walks you through it. The ChatGPT says, here's your receipt. But there's no, here's what the tool does, any of that stuff. And it's a really strange way to do business that we're having in the market right now, where there's clearly no marketers. Clearly no marketers work at OpenAI, right? Like, and usually there's always marketers ruin everything, right? As soon as venture capitalists get in, the companies always change. And for some reason, it ChatGPT be like, no, we're not doing anything that's going to grow our company or get us more customers or give a better customer experience. And it's a confidence in the product, which I kind of admire, but it's the reason people think it's a fad, because they try and use it once, they get a bad result, and they go, oh, this doesn't even really work. So people, everyone's talking about how cool it is. They're just kind of, they don't believe them anymore because they try it once and get a bad result. Because if you write a bad prompt, you are going to get a bad result. But how would you know what a good or bad prompt is when there's no way to find out? In fact, most people don't even know what the word prompt means, because ChatGPT is really, it doesn't teach you anything. It just makes you try and figure it out on your own.
Sorry about that. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, because I've had to really dive into, I've taken courses, I've YouTube a lot of stuff on learning about prompts and everything, and it's helped me grow my podcast with the way I structure my show, with, and the thing is, like you said, you have to have the proper prompts for you to get the results that you want. And of course, I've tried so many different prompts until I got the prompts that I wanted to use, and it worked the way I wanted it to work. But it took me getting to want to know how to use it, and experimenting, and again, YouTube and stuff, and asking. And I had a friend who was getting into it. I've met some people who have really delved into it, and they've helped me out somewhat. And I love it. I really do. I use it to help me. Like I said, I've been using it the last year, and it's helped me grow my podcast because it cuts back on so much time. It saves me on so much time doing my podcast.
Yeah, that's the best thing it does, is it makes you faster. A lot of people who hype it up are like, oh, it's going to replace this worker and that worker, and all the people are going to be fired. It's like, no, man, it just makes everyone faster. And I always say it makes me 20% faster. Then all these studies show it makes people 40% faster, which is really cool. So I need to catch up. And that's the thing, is that you hear that, then you go to use it. And ChatGPT has forced the creation of a secondary market, because they don't, it's like when you first got a video game in the 80s, it would come with instructions and kind of teach you how to get through the levels and show a picture of every character, tell you what the backstory is and what the buttons did. Then they stopped including the instruction manual. So what happened? third-party companies started making instruction manuals and started selling instruction manuals at GameStop and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So that created that business because the main company goes, well, I'm not going to make instruction manuals. And someone goes, okay, I'll fill in the gap. And so now that ChatGPT goes, hey, I'm not going to give any instructions, it's created exactly that market on YouTube, the market in a lot of other places where people are selling courses because you don't have any other choice. But there's all these certain type of person who thinks, oh, there's no instructions here, I'll go to YouTube and watch a training video. And there's also only a certain type of person who will think, oh, my first prompt didn't work, I'll keep trying until I find one that works. A lot of people will go, my first prompt didn't work, guess this doesn't work, guess this is broken. So it's a really small percentage of people. Only 14% of people have ever tried ChatGPT even once. And out of that group of people, way, way less have tried it twice because they had a bad experience. And it really is that if you have to be someone who's doing all these extra steps because they've created the market this way. And while it's a good thing for me, it's the reason what I'm doing exists. It also means that for a lot of people, they hope it's a fad. I saw someone post on Twitter and get a bunch of likes in the last couple weeks that said, like, oh, I'm glad no one's talking about that fad ChatGPT again. And I was like, man, this is from the person who's going to be fired in 6 months when the boss is like, sorry, we found someone who does ChatGPT to do your, they can do twice the job of you for the same price. It's a really, it reminds me of 30 years ago when Napster came on the scene, right when I had gotten to college. It was like Metallica was suing them, the record companies were suing them, everyone was suing each other, stop and put the genie back in the bottle. But you can't. Like, no one uses Napster anymore, right? Like, who owns Napster? That's right. That software is dead. But that's the reason that Spotify exists, right? Because it might not be ChatGPT, it might come and go, right? It might be a different AI tool next year and the next year. But the idea out the bottle, this technology that everyone has, and the fact that, like, there's so many open source AIs, like, you cannot hit undo on this technology. And so once it gets out and proliferates, you can't stop it. As much as you want to say it's a fad or disappears, it's like, it's so fundamental and so changes it. Now, when I was a kid, like, I used to own CDs. The thought of not owning a CD, the thought of, like, renting music, like on Spotify, you rent the music, right? You pay a fee, you don't pay that fee, no more music. Mm-hmm. It's not yours anymore. Remember, you own the album, you have the album art. Sometimes the album has the lyrics inside, and usually sometimes it doesn't.
Then nobody's gonna remember when you used to look in and see where it was recorded, what studio,
yeah,
shout outs, everything like that. And I remember when I used to get the cassettes. So
yeah. And exactly. Remember, like, and you would even get a cassette, like, as a present from someone, like, as, like, a mixtape. And the things back then, making a mixtape was hard. To make a mixtape for someone, like, you'd be listening to K-Rock, and then you're waiting for the song and playing, like, record. Yeah. And you have one of those boom boxes with two boxes, and it's, like, a really big deal to make a mixtape. Then it was CDs. It kind of made it easier. But with tape, not easy at all. You had to hear it in real time, and it made it really valuable. All of that has become, like, an artifact of history. Like, now kids use that. Like, my kids are like, when I'm like, yeah, when I was in high school and I got a pager, I felt so cool. They're like, what's a pager? And I explained, and they go, that sounds stupid. I'm like, no. Someone could message you and you knew to call them back. It was like, to be reachable and be able to, and you go and use a payphone. Now I have to explain what a payphone is because they've never seen one of those. Like, there is, technology does shift. Like, a lot of people, and sometimes it takes a while. Like, it was the car phone, and you could only have a, and then you had, like, the cell phone was, like, attached to a briefcase. And now everyone has a cell phone. Like, the thought of not having a smartphone, I remember when, you know, before the iPhone. So we go through these technological shifts, and there are people who go, I'm never going to join it. I'm going to stick with my flip phone. I'm still going to use a StarTAC for 10 years, which is fine. But eventually it becomes inevitable. Like, it becomes a fait accompli. It's like either you learn it or you don't. Like, you can be an accountant who doesn't use spreadsheets. You're just not getting any clients. So you can be someone who doesn't use any AI tools, but no one's going to work with you, and you're going to go out of business because you just aren't fast enough. It's really, it's not that AI is a replacement for anyone. It's just, it lets you do boring tasks faster, right? Like, in the past, for a podcast, to write show notes, you either got to hire someone and it takes 2 hours, 3 hours of their time because they got to listen to the show, then they got to write their notes, then you got to check to make sure they didn't do anything dumb. So it's at least 30 minutes, an hour of your time, and 2 hours of their time. Now, an AI can write the show notes for this episode and write amazing show notes about me in like 15 or 30 seconds. Yeah. So it's, and you can check it in 10 minutes. So even with the human check, it's still faster. And that agility, especially like when you're starting out a podcast, you're a solopreneur, writing the show notes, writing the description, remembering all the links and all that stuff. That's the worst part of it. The interview part, this part's the best part. Everything else about recording a podcast is the worst. Yeah. Then you got to make the clips. When I first started my podcast, you had to open up your video editor, resize, make a different shape, and slowly find the spots you want by watching it again, right? And just listening to which parts you go, oh, this is a good clip for social media. Now, there's AI tools that will make 20 clips from an interview with anyone in a bunch of different formats and sizes, and you just pick which clips you like. Mm-hmm. Instead of listening back to an hour of audio, you just listen to 12, 20, 30 second clips. And now you should spend 10 minutes of listening instead of an hour. And they're all kind of already pre-designed and stuff. And it's amazing. Well, so these tools make it faster.
They have Opus Clip. And what they do, they give you 30 clips and they actually rate them. They'll give you the 99%. These are the most, like the highest one. And so you will take those clips. So yes, it has made life so much easier for me as a podcaster. I don't have to figure out what I'm going to put in the description. I take whatever bio my guest has, whatever information my guest gives me. I feed it into ChatGPT. It comes out with a wonderful description of what the show is going to basically be about, because that's what we're going to talk about. So tell us about your best-selling book, ChatGPT Profits. What inspired you to write it, and what key insights can readers expect from it?
Sure. So I never intended to write a book about ChatGPT. A couple of things kind of came together for a confluence. First is that I started grabbing all the books that were selling really well. There's a couple of books about ChatGPT that sell really, really well, and they're really bad. So they're full of prompts that don't work. And then I went and realized, I was like, and they have like more than 1,000 reviews for a new book. I go, this book is so hot. And then I realized they're paid for reviews. They're bot reviews or AI written reviews. I was like, this is not cool. So what's happened is people buy the book, they read the book, they go use ChatGPT, doesn't work. They go, this AI thing doesn't really work. It's all hoopla. I bought the best-selling book about it, it didn't work. So they stop using ChatGPT. And what happens in 2 years, they lose their job. Who's like, no, I tried it, didn't work. What do you mean AI works, right? I bought the bestseller, right? And that really bothered me. I was like, if you're going to put in all the effort, why not just also make the book good? But a lot of people are pulling the shenanigans with some sketchy reviews. And you always eventually get caught on Amazon. It's just a question of not if, it's just when. There's some sketchy reviews going on. And then they also have content clearly written by the AI. I said, ChatGPT, write a bunch of prompts for me. And it's not, they just don't work. Or the explanation's not there. So I said, what really stinks is that they give you all these prompts, but they don't show you what's supposed to happen. So if I tell you, do something, and then I don't tell you what's going to happen when you do it, how do you know if you did it right? Right? If you're trying to learn how to throw a baseball and you don't have a video of me throwing it and how you twist your arm and all that stuff to get the different pitches, you're never going to figure out a slider, right? If you can't see, if I describe the windup, but then I don't show the slider going across home plate, how do you know if you've done a slider right unless you've seen it? So with my book, what was really important to me is that you can see me write a prompt and you can see the actual answer from ChatGPT. Even if I misspell something, I left the misspellings in because it's authentic. So if I forget to capitalize in a prompt, and I only used actual prompts that I'd used over the previous 6 months, I'm only gonna use stuff that actually happened. And only in a few cases, I did have to rerun the prompt because it was like, oh, this is from a year ago. So it's ChatGPT 3.5. Let me show you ChatGPT 4.0. But I tell you that. And every time I'm prompting, it's in bold. And every time ChatGPT's answering, it's in italics. So there's no chance of you mistaking what I wrote for what the AI wrote. And what that allows me to do is give you really example. And I tell at the beginning, I'm like, listen, this book's going to be a little bit long because it's got answers and responses. Just know that going in, the only way I can teach you. I cannot teach you if you get to hear half the phone conversation, but not the responses, right? Like I can say, this prompt works, I promise. But you don't know unless you try it. Like, and I'm winking at you. That's cool, but it's not helpful. So that's really what drove me to write the book, was the desire to write a book that gives people an actual instruction manual with prompts that actually work, not theory, and with an actual response. So then you can, when you copy the prompt, and if you get a completely different answer, you know, something went wrong, right? You know, you didn't copy it right, or that something got twisted. And that's important because it's very, very, very hard to prompt engineer if you're starting out. Most people don't need to do that. What you just want to do is copy and paste something that works, right? Would you rather just have one prompt that works when you need show notes, or you want something where you spend 6 hours figuring out or 6 weeks figuring out? Like, no, I'd rather just have the prompt that works. Like, just give me the shortcut. That's what's helpful for most people. So that's really the way it's designed, is to be modular. You read the chapter that has a skill you want to learn, copy paste the prompt to describe that, and that you're off to the races. That's really how it's designed to be, is to kind of solve that problem and to make it easier for people to actually learn ChatGPT in a really, like, very simple fashion.
So with two successful AI training programs, AI Freedom and Fractional AIO, Can you give us a glimpse into what participants can learn and achieve from using these courses?
Sure. So with AI Freedom, which is becoming a new program, which is called Cyber Staffing Agency, it really teaches you how to build out your own business, where each different role is filled by a different AI or different AI version or different set of prompts. So it kind of creates like, oh, this is my Pinterest AI. So when I put this into ChatGPT, it becomes a Pinterest expert. This is the prompt that turns into a copywriting expert. This is the prompt that turns into a podcast planning expert. So that way you have like these different employees that can just do a job for you when you need it, right? You only need an account sometimes. So you kind of can create ChatGPT as a specialist. And that's really designed for someone who wants to work on their own business. And that's designed for someone who maybe they want to do coaching, which is like, oh, I'll tell you a little bit how to do AI. That's as far as they go. The other end of the market is fractional AIL, which is someone who goes, you know what? I want to do services for small companies. I want to go into a small company. I work there 2 hours a week. I help them set up all their AI systems. I tell them what software to buy. Most people would love a professional to tell them which tools they should buy, because it's hard. I spent last week for Fraction AIO, I had to review 69 different pieces of software. I was supposed to do like 3 or 4 more, and I just go, I can't do anymore. Because so many tools don't work the way they said they would, have a glitch in the tech, have a sketchy problem with the checkout, all these issues, or they just don't have an AI, they're faking it. And my job is to catch that. So I caught a bunch of tools. I was like, this tool's not using AI, it's using heuristic, it's using machine learning, or just faking it overall. And that's important to teach my people. So it's really hard. Wouldn't you love if I just told you, hey, there's 100 AIs, I'll just tell you the 3 that work? That's what everyone wants, right? So there's this need for small businesses, because every business knows they need AI, but they don't know what they need, and they can't tell good from bad AI. So I teach you how to become an AI master, how to do every single process with SOPs, how to write a blog post, how to do keyword research, how to plan a social media campaign, how to design a social media image, how to design each part of the process, how to edit a video fast, how to edit a podcast fast, all these different categories. It just gives you all these skills. So you can go to a company and kind of look at their processes and go, oh, you don't need this software anymore, you can use this one. You know, this software anymore, there's a free way of doing it. You don't need that AI software, it's overpriced, it doesn't do what it says it's going to do. All these things. There's so many tools out there that are like AI writers right now, and all of them are bad, because they can't be good, because every single one of them is just a wrapper for ChatGPT, right? So they're all charged more than ChatGPT, and they all do less because it's ChatGPT, but with less features. Why would anyone want that? So every time I see that, I see an opportunity to teach people that these softwares are just kind of grabbing a part of the market and not helping it very much. So why have a less powerful version for more money? It doesn't make sense. Usually the more powerful version is more expensive. So I really help you to figure out what are the right tools for every different company, and how to say to a company, hey, you don't need this. It doesn't fit your business model, right? Like, why do you need a software that helps you on LinkedIn if you guys don't use LinkedIn marketing? So you don't need to invest in that. That's really important, because we're at a time where everyone knows they need AI. They're not sure which they need. So they have no idea what it's supposed to cost. And it can become very overwhelming. It's very easy to spend a lot of money on AI tools. And the thing is, if they're really expensive, they're probably not the best tools. The most expensive tools tend to be the least effective tools right now. It's a really interesting time. So your bill for AI tech should be like, for a big company, should be like $32 a month. Like, all you need is Midjourney and ChatGPT to do 99% of what I teach. There's a few specialized tools that do help a little bit more, but in most cases, they just help for convenience. They don't give you a better response than ChatGPT. They just give you a faster response.
Yeah. So also, as a celebrity ghostwriter, what are some of the most memorable projects you've worked on, and how does AI influence your work in that field?
Yeah. One of the biggest things that I've always dealt with is that when I turn in a rough draft, I'm like, listen, I haven't edited the grammar. There's no spelling check, because I'm not going to spend time fixing the grammar for chapters you're going to cut out of the book, right? So I deliver something in rough draft. Usually the book changes about 30% between rough draft and final draft. So if I spend time editing it all, cleaning it all up, or paying someone to do that, it's a wasted money, because I've done that before. And then they just delete 3 of the chapters. I'm like, well, I spent 12 hours editing that and you just deleted it. So I always say, here's the rough draft, it's rough. Now I can run the whole book through ChatGPT and deliver a higher quality thing. And I don't have to explain that to people, right? Because it just fixes it in a couple of hours. So the kind of the ROI is there for me to actually do it. So that's one of the biggest places I use it, is that it allows me to deliver a product. It helps me through editing and cleaning up. And just along the way, it's an assistant. that allows me to help people a little bit more. And as far as actually like the most memorable moments, I mean, the biggest thing my job is as a ghostwriter is to tell people when they're being boring or when something they want to put in the book is going to offend people. Because sometimes people want to put in something really bad. And I've had clients just want, biggest fight I ever have with a client, he's like, listen, I got a story I want to put in the book. My dad was in one hospital, just thought he was going to die. My mom was sick. She was in a different hospital. They were separated from each other. It was a really tough time. And I hurt my shoulder at the gym. And I was like, yeah, that part about your shoulder makes you look real bad. Right. It's like that. You can't add the third thing in. That's like, oh, but I was hurting too. I was like, yeah, they're in the hospital. Right. Separated and married after 20 years. And he was like, all right, I got another one. This is about the time I left my fiance at the altar. And I was like, that's a villain story. Right. That's the start of how you became Darth Vader, not how you became Luke Skywalker. Like, you cannot leave someone at the altar and be the hero of the story. Like, no matter what happens next, you can leave someone at the altar and then go save 50 babies. You're still a bad guy who saved babies. Like, it doesn't matter. It's such a bad thing, no matter how you spin it. Oh, no, I told her the day before. It doesn't matter, man. There's no scenario, especially when you're the guy canceling the wedding. There's no scenario where, unless she did something horrible first, which is not happening here, then you can get out. But you can't. And he was like, I got to put that in the book. I was like, man, people will hate you. I've had that. Or I had another client who she said she could tell the future like a little bit. And I was like, don't put that in there because your phone is going to be ringing. That's all people are going to. It's one sentence. I said, everyone's going to be asking about that one sentence. Right? Like, how would you not? The rest of the book is, I said, if you say, actually, I ran into someone the other day who said the same thing, like, oh, I have a little bit of intuition. And I forget where I saw it, like in their LinkedIn profile or something. Like, once you say that, that's what the conversation's about. If you tell me, oh, I can a little bit tell the future, and like 20% of women, I think it's something like a really large percentage of women think they can do that a little bit. It's amazing. It's because there's not a lot of guys that say that. Like, guys won't, you very rarely meet a guy who goes, yeah, I can tell the future. And who says a little bit? It's like, No. Either you can tell the future, future, give me the lottery numbers for tomorrow, right? Tell me what's going to happen. Like, tell me something's going to happen, because that's a really, just for how we see the world. And this is just one of those differences. Like, we see the world so differently, but it's like, if you say that, it could be one, like, to you, it's a throwaway sentence. I was like, to most people read that book, this is a book about someone who can see the future. Now you got to prove it. I was like, because that's all I'm going to be asking. And the rest of the book's not around that. Or sometimes people put in things like, I had a client who's like, on the cover of the book, it's going to be all the people throughout history, the religious heroes, Gandhi, Jesus, Buddha, and Islam, just bowing to me. And I said, listen, man, people from Islam like don't think that's cool. I said, you put that on the book, cover of the book, you're going to have a situation. He was like, okay, I'll just wait till it's a bestseller and then put that on the cover. I was like, man, people really, they don't like drawings of Muhammad. They'd especially picture Muhammad bowing to you. It's going to be like a real situation, right? And I finally could, fortunately, the book went bestseller, did really well, and he didn't do that. Like, he didn't change it. But that can happen, is that sometimes people just have like an idea. And it's my job to go, listen, that will make you look bad. Sometimes people misinterpret it. So there's a sentence in one of my books where I go, you know, at a lot of conferences, all the speakers go to a room and do a little something naughty together, like, because they're hanging out. And if you can be in that room, you can be involved in all the deals. And someone's like, oh, the only way to succeed is to do things really. I was like, that's not what I said. I just said you got to be in the room where they're hanging out. Like, that's a misinterpretation, because I tell an entire story about a guy who never partakes and really grew his business just by being in the right place at the right time. But people hear what they want to. That's one sentence in a book of 405 pages. And I've gotten I had someone write a really long review just about that one sentence. And I was like, you misinterpreted the sentence. So anytime there's an opportunity for misinterpretation, it's my job to catch that. Because some, like, the intention of, oh, I have a little bit of intuition is not to say I can tell the future, right? But that's what people are going to hear. Anytime there's room for interpretation. So the biggest challenge I've had is when it's not the rock star telling a story about all the cool stuff that's happened. I'm like, that stuff is cool. It's whenever they accidentally put something that people can hear and hear, and it can sound like offensive, right? Sometimes something sounded really funny at the time. Like, when me and my friends in college, man, we used to say some stuff I could never put in a book. Right, people, because it doesn't sound the same, and it can sound really different. Even me and my wife are from two different races. I forget that all the time. But man, some of the stuff that, like, we have these huge cultural differences. English is not her first language. I didn't even realize she was faking it for the first year we were together. She was pretending she could speak English. I just thought she was quiet. And here's what happened when we were at the movie. I didn't find out for a year. We used to watch a movie together every day. And then we went to the theater and saw Taken 3. I had to go to the bathroom. I came back and I say, hey, what happened while I was gone? And when she told me her answer, I was like, oh, she doesn't speak English. That's the movie she described. First of all, the movie she was describing was so much better than the movie we were watching. I was like, first of all, I want to be watching the movie you're talking about because that sounds awesome. So I realized that's why she loved watching movies with me, because every movie we saw, she thought something else was happening. And it was always better. So for a long time, I'd always ask her, hey, what just happened in that movie? And she would tell me the story. She was like, oh, that was a love story between this guy and this woman. I was like, those characters are brother and sister. Like the story you saw. So she used to see, have told different interpretation, right? And so people on the outside can see it one way, whereas it's like, it's not that like she was having a bad time. She was seeing better movies than me because she only understood part of it. Now, of course, she's totally fluent and it was just, it is what it is, right? I was like, oh, we just don't talk that much. We just hang out. But it's very easy for the outside in for things to sound different, or for people to see the world in a different way. Like she's got some strong opinions that like you can't say in America. And it's just like normal where she's from, because it just is what is it. Like she grew up where she grew up. It's so poor. You don't have time to have opinions about a lot of stuff. Like when you're surviving, like she like ate like wild. She would they capture wild animals and eat them all the time when she was like 5 and 6. Like that's not how we grew up. Like you, not a lot of people in America have like eaten a pigeon or like a stray dog when they're like 5 or 6 years old, right? Like, and it's survival. So you don't have a lot of thoughts about things that you have time. Like she doesn't have a lot of thoughts about vegetarianism. She's like, I don't know what that is. You know, like I don't have time. Like there's not enough vegetables that I got to go find something. I got to dig something up. Like she has a very great strength of willpower, but it comes from a different place. And like a lot of people who grow up differently, like they have time to think about all these other things. She's like, some of the stuff people talk about in movies and stuff, she's like, I don't know how they have time for that. Like, she's like, after school, you got to go find your dinner, right? And when she says find your dinner, she means go find it. Like, you're outside looking for something to eat, and it's a completely different perspective. So it really reminds me of a different world. Like, you know, when I came home from school, I was like, what am I going to watch on TV? She's like, man, my toy when I was a kid was a stick. So it kind of resets your perspective of the world, but a lot of times, when people are telling a story, it can sound or be misinterpreted in a certain way. And so sometimes like she thinks tell her stories in a way, she's like, oh, people are just going to think I'm like poor animal. I'm like, no, people are going to think you're strong. Like people are going to think like the things that she thinks are what make her like the worst, like the reason I'm with her, like her ability to endure, her perspective on life, her strength. That's the thing I like the most. Like, man, she's so strong that I know that when things go bad, we can handle it because she's been through stuff that's so tough. Like it's interesting that the part of her that she's like, oh, people are going to think that's the worst. But man, people think that's the best. And that's most cases, right? Often we go, oh, this is my biggest weakness. Like, yeah, that's what everyone likes about you. Like your biggest weakness is the reason everyone admires you. So sometimes all of those things are there. So when I'm working with clients, sometimes they're like, this is my best story. And I go, yeah, that story's not going to the book. Like I've had clients give me like, I had a client, he gave me 18 hours of audio. And I'm like, I lose 15 seconds of it. I was like, the rest of this is unusable. And my job is really, the most important thing for me is not to make people look smart. Like that's not ghostwriting. Ghostwriting is not making people look smart. We don't like smart people, right? Like no one really likes smart people. No one follows them. Like if you watch CNN and you see an interview with someone and that person then is on Fox News, you're not going to follow the interviewer, right? You're going to stay with the person you like, not the expert. We don't swap between. That's why I don't think there's any crossover between any news channel, right? Whatever news channel you like, that's the one you like because you like the anchor, who's the personality, not the smartness. They don't get those jobs because they're smart. They get those jobs because they're pretty. So you get locked in whatever. And it's the same way with a book. So my job is like not to make you look smart. It's just to make you look like above moron. So as long as you're above that, like don't say anything that lets people know you're more. And that's what I have to watch out for, those landmines. You're all good. Because people go, okay, he's not an idiot. I like him. I'll buy whatever he's selling. I'll buy his next book, whatever. That's really how people read nonfiction. Is they want the likability more. And some people are very unlikable. So you have to really work, or the way they tell stories is like really, it comes across the wrong way, especially like if they're on the spectrum or whatever, like they tell a story, like it just sounds mean or bad. And so I was working on a project one time and this guy was so rich. His dad gave him $500 million to start a company when he was in his 20s. And that's a tough one. That's tough to be relatable. Like my dad, if he'd give me $500 million, I don't think I would have started a company. I think I would have just retired. And he told this story. It was so funny. It was a lot of people think my dad gave me money to start my first business. He goes, he didn't. It was my second business because he did like a small business with a buddy in college, right? That didn't work out. And that's very funny because now it's like he's aware of it. And if you can be self-aware enough to know, yeah, I know that everyone thinks I'm a daddy's boy because of this, but I tried to start a company once and it didn't work out. That's funny. Like, it's how else can you be relatable, right? Because it's like, that person does not know suffering, does not know struggle. He does know the pressure of my negative $500 million. I better not lose it, right? Like, there's that pressure there, but not relatable. So when you can be relatable, right? Like, if you grew up rich and you never had any struggles, but like, I need to put in a story about the time like you got beat up or the time people like really were rough on you, then people go, okay, this person's rich, but at least it's punched in the mouth, right? Like, we all want to read a story about a rich person getting punched in the mouth, whatever it is, right? Or if you grew up really poor and really dangerous, right? Then you have to have a story about like your family, right? We want to hear an element of vulnerability. So my job is to find that part of you that's likable and to know when I find it. And the other thing about me is that I have a really short attention span. I get bored really fast. So I'm interviewing the client and I get, as soon as I start getting bored, I'm like, we got to change the subject. So there's no chance of me leaving boring stuff in the book because I'm like, I already get zoned out. I'm like, yeah, we can't keep that. It's too boring. It's a lot of people think that what they're going to write is their biography, which is not what you're going to write. Like, you can't, no one reads biographies, like, unless it's a Kardashian or someone's already famous, or you get caught doing something real bad, like a serial killer, or turned out you were a spy. Like, I think they just caught someone in the government that turns out he was a spy. They found a bunch of gold in his house. That's a biography people want to read, right? Like, if people find gold in your house, you're like, wow, that's like a real dumb spy decision. Like, hey, how do you want to be paid? Something completely unrealistic that no one would have in their house, right? Like, just pay me in, I don't know, truffles. So I'll have a house full of truffles. And when people search the house, I'll go, oh no, I'm just a fan of French food. Like, you have $17 million in gold coins in your house, like, that no one's ever heard about. And they got Russian writing on them. Like, that's the kind of stuff that's like so crazy. That's a biography people read. But most of the time, what we read is the story, someone's personal story mixed in with a lesson, right? Like, so it's teaching me how to do something, and then their personal stories illustrate that. That's what people want. So I help people find that balance of, you can tell us, you want the book to be full of stories about yourself, but it always has to be there for a reason. Like, why are you telling the story about your aunt? Why are you telling the story about high school? It has to be there for a reason. And so it helps people to have these guide rails to know when they're interesting and when they're boring, especially when people are really successful. Like, if you're really successful and really beautiful and you're boring, people won't tell you. Like, if, you know, we've all been on a date with a woman who's so beautiful, she can say just about anything. We just go, wow, that's a great story. You're hilarious. And you're inside your head going, that's the worst story I've ever heard. Right? Like, I think this girl might be a monster. It's very much that danger. Like, people that are really wealthy, no one ever tells them the truth. It's really hard. That's why, like, all really wealthy people, they marry their high school girlfriend because you're the only one that will treat them like a normal person. It is that element of, oh, you knew me before I was famous. You're normal around me, right? You won't always just tell me yes to every one of my bad ideas, because sometimes that's why a lot of careers end that way, right? Like, a celebrity picks a movie and the manager's like, yeah, that sounds great, whatever movie you want. And it's like a bad move and it kind of messes up their career. All that stuff matters. You want to be around people that are going to tell you the truth, even when you might get mad at them and you have a lot of power. It's hard to find that. So it's like when a Roman emperor would come home from winning a war, there'd be someone who stands next to him and goes, you're still human. You're still human, dude. Right? Especially because those guys got assassinated a lot. So that's a good reminder to have. It's like, yeah, you won right now, but don't forget you're still human. These people could turn against you. And it's good to have that reminder. We don't do that anymore, right? And so sometimes people have like some just, it's not that the stories are bad. It's usually just they're so boring and they're so interesting. I worked with someone once who had written like 30 pages about a mixer in the kitchen. And I was like, I can't believe you got past three sentences. Because that's a device that it spins, use it for making cookies. What color is it? That's it. Like, why are you giving it a whole story? And he was like, no, this could be the most interesting part of the book. And I was like, I've got good and bad news for you. I was like, good news is it's going to be the most interesting part of the book because I'm cutting it all out. This has to go. Because it's so, that's the bad news. It's got to go. The good news is once it's gone, the book will be good. But that's the thing. It's very easy, even for myself. What I think is the most interesting story about me is not going to be what you find the most interesting. So like the good thing about podcasts like this or live interviews, if you start yawning a bunch, I go, oh, change this. I know to move on, right? I can look for cues, but if I'm just writing a book, there's no signs that a section is boring. So that's really how you help people, because a lot of people don't know how to tell their stories in an interesting way. And sometimes this is one of my favorite ones. This is my final favorite ones. Someone came to me and goes, listen, I don't know if this is interesting. He goes, during the Vietnam War, I was actually fighting in Cambodia as a spy, which was illegal. There was only 10 of us. We never admitted any spies were in Cambodia. He says, I did that for 10 years, completely off the books, no cover in Cambodia. And then when I finished that, my wife was in the Russian ballet as a spy, and I was a spy in the Russian embassy for 20 years representing America. He goes, is that interesting? And I was like, do you not know what the word interesting means? I was like, you literally just told me the most interesting thing I've heard in my entire life. And I always know if someone says to me, hey, I think this is boring, but maybe it's not, they're about to tell me something crazy. That was literally the most interesting thing anyone said to me in my entire life. And he was like, I think no one would be interested in this because it's really boring. I was like, I'm sorry, did you say you were a super spy for how many years? Wife was undercover in the Russian ballet? That sounds not real, right? And I met the wife too. I talked to her on a phone call. I was like, guys, you guys are awesome. Right? Your stories are amazing. Everyone wants to hear these, right? But they think that way. Another guy came to me, he goes, listen, I don't know if this is interesting. He goes, one time I jackknifed my truck. I'm flying across the freeway. It's sparking and I'm heading towards a gas station. He goes, is that interesting? And I was like, that's the opening scene of Fast and the Furious. That's very interesting. Like, I've never had someone say, I'm not sure if this is interesting, and then tell me something boring. The more they think it's boring, the more crazy the story is. Another person was like, yeah, so I don't know if this is a good way to start a book, but I'm supposed to do parachuting. I'm in a single engine plane. The engine dies. Is that interesting? I was like, What's happening? So I've discovered that people have this, if people think their story is really interesting, it's usually not. If people think their story is really boring, it's going to be something so crazy. Everyone, even if you've never been skydiving, you can relate to a plane's engine dying, right? We all know that's scary. Like, you don't have to say much past that for me to already be nervous, right? And it's like, it's not high enough for you to jump. She goes, Anna, it wasn't high enough for me to jump out. I had a parachute, but it wouldn't open in time if I jumped out. I'm like, okay, now you made it worse. Like, now I'm having like a little bit of a heart situation because it's like my biggest fear is like, I have a parachute and it's not going to work. I didn't know that was an option, right? And it's like, so the amazing, that's my favorite part of the job is when people tell me something absolutely amazing and it's a game changer because they just don't realize. They like, everyone has a story and some people think, oh, my story's not interesting. And then they tell it and it's like so amazing. Like, one of my clients, he had me write a book about his father. And he's like, yeah, I don't know if this is interesting. My father was like the 11th black person in the US Army. And I was like, that's still pretty early, right? Like, that's pretty early, top 10, top 11, whatever. And it was like an amazing story. Right when they did desegregation, he grew up totally segregation. He ended his life totally desegregation, right? All these amazing events. I was like, that's an amazing thing, right? Like, to be at a time that's like, so outside of my understanding. That was one of the hardest things ever to write because I don't know what that feels like, right? I've never experienced segregation at all, let alone from the other side of it. And so that was a really hard book to write because it was about his dad and stuff. It's like, you got to get it right. But he loved it, right? I found pictures of his dad he's never seen before. I found the parents' marriage announcement in a newspaper, all sorts of cool things he'd never seen before because I'm good at research. I was like, this is a really interesting story. And it was really cool to see that whenever someone says, I don't know if this is interesting, but it's always about to be, I get so excited because it's always something good.
All right. So one of the things that I've been doing this past year is affiliate marketing. What are some of the essential tips for finding success and building a lucrative partnership in affiliate marketing?
What a lot of people are tempted to do is represent hundreds of products. And you just say everything you use and talk about every tool you use. That's really hard because you're always talking about something new. You're always talking about something different. And each product you have a small relationship with, like, you don't really matter that much to them. But maybe you generate one or two sales for a product a year and you have this small relationship with each of them, which is fine, but it means that you're never going to make the big money. The really big opportunity is when you find your flagship offer, right? The thing that you talk about generates sales. There are certain things that I just have sold hundreds of units of, right, over the years that, like, okay, that's what I'm going to talk about the most. I'm going to write more blog posts about this one thing. And then you kind of become an expert on that one thing, whatever it is. So it's more important to find your unicorns. When I talk about this, I'm talking about the product that's like the one you're going to ride, that's going to represent 80% of your affiliate income. And a lot of people don't know what to look for. Like, it used to be, this isn't anymore because they changed their filmmaking. People come in all the time like, oh, I want to just represent Canva. I was like, don't you have to sell like a thousand Canvas to make $1,000? Because you get people to sign up for Canva, you don't get paid. It's only when they switch to the pro plan you get paid, and you have to have so many people do it. And now they don't even let you be, now to be in their program, they've added a bunch of rules. I'm not in their affiliate program anymore because it's not worth it to me. Like, you have to publish a certain number of videos every month reviewing and demonstrating Canva techniques. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's got to be your full-time job. So for the people that are big Canva reps, it's great. For the people that are medium, it's just not worth the time. And that's the thing, is that I look at how many, I always look at how many units do I have to sell to make $1,000? And it, some products, it's like, I got to sell 77 of these. Whereas it's just as hard for me to sell a product that costs $2,000 as it costs $20. So why would I sell a product that costs $20? It's the same amount of effort, right? It's like, hey, do you want to, you got two jobs. Job A, you work 40 hours a week, you make $100,000. Job B, you work 40 hours a week, you make $20,000 a year. Why would you take job B? So a lot of people have some really beliefs. They go, oh, I don't want to sell expensive things. People don't want to spend money. Like, times are tough. And I get that. But here's the thing. There's certain products, when it drops below a certain price, people don't trust it. Like, if I said to you, I got a Ferrari, it's $47. You're like, something must be wrong with that Ferrari. We talk about Matchbox car. You think it's a trick. And this is a mistake a lot of products make, because when they price too low. So if you promote a lot of stuff that's really cheap, people start to think, oh, just nothing you sell works. Like, I see all these products that are like, I'll teach you how to be a millionaire, $7. I'm like, okay, there's something wrong here. Because if you teach you how to be a millionaire, it's going to be worth more than $7, right? It's going to be worth them. So if you price too low, it kind of affects the way people perceive you. And it just makes it harder to make that sale. Like, you think you're doing something right. And there are certain places where, yeah, people want low ticket, right? People expect, like, no one expects an iPhone game to cost $175, right? But it's, we get caught up so often in kind of that. So the first thing is kind of choosing the right thing to promote, something that gives you a high commission, right? Amazon is the worst thing to promote as an affiliate, because physical products pay the lowest. There's products on Amazon that pay 0%. Like, if you sell and someone goes and buys a bunch of wine, you get nothing. You get 0% of that. And I'm used to programs that pay 50 to 75%. So if I sell something for 2,000, I get 1,000. If I sell something for 3,000, I get 1,500. So I think about the percentage of the dollar my customer spends. Like, someone came to me recently and goes, hey, listen, I got a thing. It's $7,000, but I'll pay you $1,000. You'll make $1,000 for each sale. I was like, yeah, but I would rather just sell to that same person. Three things that each cost $2,000. Now I'm getting paid. They spend less than I make $2,000. So I always look at that ratio of how much money I get. Because when I started out, I thought the product was the value. The value was the customer. Bringing a customer is so valuable. I want half, because I know you're going to sell other stuff to them down the line. So I'm bringing you some real magic. So as an affiliate, the first thing is you want to look for products that, like, are good, not too many things. Then you want things that are a lot, make a lot of money. And the other thing is that whenever you're promoting, always ask for more money. Just say, hey, listen, you think you can give me a commission bump? And you'd be amazed how many people go, sure, we'll give you an extra 10% just because you asked. Even really big companies. And I learned this from my friend Joe. He was like, yeah, I just ask everyone. He's like, worst thing they say is no, I'm at the commission. They turn it out. And you'll be surprised how many people, like, don't even think about it. They just bump you because it's just part of their system. They have that ability in there. And you can get a 10%. So let's say you're getting paid 50%. Now you get bumped to 60%. That's actually a 20% increase in your income. You can't go to your boss and say, hey, can I get a 20% raise? Like, no way. Whereas you can get it as an affiliate. And the other, the big opportunity and the big mistake is that a lot of people, when they're starting out, they create their own product and they get traffic, right? Maybe it's from Pinterest, maybe it's from a Facebook ad, doesn't matter. And they're not making any sales. You don't know, is the problem the traffic is bad, or is the problem the funnel's bad, right? Is the problem the sales page? I don't know, because it could be either one. It could be chicken and the egg. But if you take traffic and send it as an affiliate to an offer that's already working and doesn't make sales, then you know the problem is the traffic. And once it's working and you're making sales, then you go, oh, I can take this traffic and now point it at my own offer that sells something similar, and it should work because I know the traffic is working. That's how you optimize, is by testing things separately. Multivariate testing, where you test different things at the same time, is mathematically impossible. Like, if you have a sales page, you go, I'm going to test the price, the color, the headline, and the subheadline all at the same time. You don't need 4 times more traffic. You need 16 times more traffic, because you're squaring and squaring and squaring. It gets crazy. So testing one element at a time is really the key to success. So affiliate marketing is absolutely, I believe, a step on the path to freedom, even if long-term you want to sell your own stuff.
All right. So it's a final question. So what's your what's your vision for the future of AI in the online business landscape? How can entrepreneurs stay ahead of the curve and utilizing these technologies?
Yeah, I think that there's going to be two types of entrepreneurs in 2 years. Those who've learned to use ChatGPT and those who don't have a business anymore. I don't think AI is optional. I think we're in a period right now where it seems like that. And a lot of people who keep their head in the sand are going to get devastated. So this could be good for people like us. Every time there's a really big shock to the market and a lot of people either have to adapt or go out of business, a lot of people lose their customers. I go, I'm just going to take their customers. Like, that's fine. They don't want to learn how to use this technology. No problem. I'll do it. I'll take their customers. And I've seen this happen before over my career a few times where a lot of people just disappear from a market. So for a while, there were a lot of people that were doing recipe books on Amazon. But with a recipe book, you need to have pictures of recipes. They're using stolen pictures. They couldn't, how else could you get it? They all got caught. Their book got taken down. A lot of them just go, I guess I'm out of business. I'll go find a job now. Instead of thinking, okay, is there a way to ethically get pictures of your recipes? Like, is there another way to do this besides? And the people who figured that out stayed in business, right? So not everyone lost, just 90%. So the people who stayed end up with a larger market share. So I think the same thing's happening now. So the first thing is to realize that it's not optional, that if you don't do something, someone's going to steal your customers. Someone's going to steal your income. They're just going to take it because that's the way it is. Everyone's mercenary. The second thing is that you have to try everything and experiment and figure out what's working for you. Don't be afraid of an AI thinking you're dumb. Like, just let go of that fear because it just doesn't matter. The AI doesn't have that type of opinion, doesn't think that well. It's not designed that way to judge you. So none of that's going to happen. Just release that. And so what if it thinks you're dumb? It's just on the path to success. I don't care. It thinks I'm dumb, but I'm making millions of dollars because my business is exploding because I figured out how to use it. What? So what if it thinks you're dumb? You're successful. So you have to really take this approach of, I'm going to learn to use these tools. It's going to be part of my business. I'm going to try every different tool. Not every tool works for every person. Like, a big part of what I do in my training program, like, look, this program works for this type of company. So there's certain software, right, that's really useful for a very small number of people. Like, I really like, for AI software, it does one thing, but it does it really well. My experience is anytime, I'll give you an example, anytime there's a software that has an image generator as well, they're like, hey, what we do is we help you design social media posts and plan your social media strategy, and we generate the image. You have to write the blog post and we generate the image. Those image generators are always so terrible. You're gonna get, if you're lucky, it's just a monster with three legs, right? That's the best you can hope for. But most of the time, it's just really boring. Like, there's some really, really bad art generation. It looks like 1970s or 1990s clip art, like just absolutely awful. So it's easy to get distracted because there are so many tools out there and think, oh my gosh, there's so many AI tools. There's really like 20 or 30 AI tools that actually work well. There's a small number of them that work well. Most of them are distractions or pretending they're AIs. And once you start to sift through and realize, okay, I just need something core. And what you can start with is just, you need a text generator and an art generator. So you either need Perplexity AI or Claude 2 or ChatGPT Pro. Each of those is $20 a month. You just pick which one you want. And you now have that covered. Second thing is you need art generator, image generator. And what you need is either DALL-E 3, which is free right now, but maybe it won't stay free. I don't know. Or Midjourney or Leonardo. Everything else that does image generation is not as good. So you're just wasting your time and you don't have to. And Midjourney is not expensive. It's $12 a month. So I pay for Midjourney and ChatGPT. I had to sign up for a bunch of other tools recently because I shoot demo videos and I have to review the software. And I was like, each time I was like, man, this is killing me. Like, just all these bills. But I got to test a tool for them to talk about it. Like, I've brought in some tools that are like $50, $60 a month that just do one thing. And I was like, if it does it really well, it's worth it, right? But I'm going to really grind during that 7-day trial to really give it a test because that stuff can add up. Not every company needs that. Like, not everyone needs to be active on LinkedIn. Not everyone needs to be active on Twitter. I don't know anyone every once in a while I meet someone who like claims they use Twitter. And I'm like, really? Because I've always thought Twitter's just bots talking to each other. And then like dummy reporters treating tweets like they're news. Like, someone writes something on the wall of a bathroom. That's not news. So it's like really crazy. Like, look at this post from an anonymous person, right? Like, I was like, is that news? Just like, I said stuff online that I don't think that should be on the news. So it's very interesting to me. That's my perspective. And maybe I'm wrong. And there's a secret group of people that really use Twitter a lot, but I've never met them. Like, you just don't meet people in real life that use MySpace, right? You don't meet someone who's like, what's your favorite social network? It's MySpace. It's Mastodon, it's Truth Social, it's Twitter. Like, you just don't meet that. And I mean, also, like, it's the same thing. Most people won't admit they like Facebook anymore. So really, it's the opportunity is that most people don't think it's serious. A lot of people think it's a fad, and that's your chance now to learn it during the optional phase before it becomes mandatory, because there's a whole generation of people coming up who are never going to experience a world without AI. My kids cannot understand a non-touchscreen. So they've always had touchscreen. You know, they're used to their tablets. Their tablets were $50 a tablet, and they have a touchscreen on. That's crazy. I remember when the first touchscreen was like $5,000, and you could just never talk. You could never have something like that. Like, and it was probably terrible. So yeah, all of these kind of phases, things become ubiquitous, right? It goes from who can afford a graphing calculator to everyone can afford a graphing calculator. It goes from who can afford spreadsheets to everyone can have a spreadsheet for free with Google Sheets. Technology goes through those phases. I remember when a DVD player was like $2,000. And now you can get a DVD player for like $7 at the store, like, because it's like such a craziness. Like, this thing's got a laser inside of it. And then Blu-ray player is the same thing. So every technology, eventually, the price just gets so low because the technology is replacing it, right? It was 8-track, yeah, then it was cassette tapes, then it was CDs, then it was laser discs for a while. Most people are like, what's a laser disc? Like, it's like a CD. It's like a record for a movie, and you have to flip it over in the middle of the movie.
Yeah, and they were huge.
Yeah, and doesn't look any. Yeah, it's just, and it's very risky. It's very easy to scratch it, and then your movie's ruined. It's like an idea that didn't work. So all of these technologies eventually kind of become very, very affordable. And the same thing's happening with AI. Like, AI, a lot of people think within a year, it's going to be in your watch. Even if you're offline, it's still going to have the AI in there because it's going to get smaller and leaner and more efficient. So that's the future. Like, I saw these guys published a white paper that said no open source AI will ever beat ChatGPT. 2 weeks later, an open source AI beat ChatGPT. Like, those guys had to be so embarrassed. They said never, and it happened 14 days later. Like, that's the worst thing that can happen. Like, this volcano will never erupt as the lava starts to come out. So free, homemade, open source, anyone can use it, completely free AIs are catching up with the AIs that are costing millions of dollars. And it's very possible that that's the future, that open source, there's some amazing open source things out there. I don't know why people build open source stuff. It's just, I have no idea why they do. They just have this passion, make the world a better place. And there's a competition. Every single day, a new better open source AI comes out, literally 7 days a week. So the future is so bright. The future is there where everyone's going to have access to technologies. There's not technology gated by price or gated by big companies because it's too much out there. They can't make, if they made ChatGPT expensive, then the open source AI would just take over the market. People are like, oh, I could pay $99 a month for ChatGPT or have a free AI that could do 90% of what ChatGPT do or 95%. Why would I pay for that extra 5%, right? It starts to become not worth it. So that's why their price is so low. So I think that for someone who's thinking about, should I get into this stuff? You don't really have a choice. You don't have to do anything overwhelming. Just start with an AI text generator and an image generator. That's enough to do 99% of what you do every day, and it's going to save you so much time.
Oh man, this has been a wonderful conversation. Now is the time where you, this was coming up to the end of the show. Now is the time where you get the solo screen, and you get to plug away and let everybody know where they can find you, where they can get the book, everything.
Sure, you can find my book at Amazon. It's ChatGPT Profits by Jonathan Green. You can find everything I teach about AI, all my courses, my books, my training, what book is coming up next. I'm working on ChatGPT Profits for social media at servenomaster.com/AI. If you just search for servenomaster in Google, every single result is me.
Awesome, man. Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show, man. I greatly appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having me. I had a good time.
Oh, yeah. Man. You are a vast book of knowledge. Yeah, like, this is why I was looking forward to it, because this is something that I'm really into, is AI and learning about AI. I'm still learning so much. So
awesome. I love it.
Being able to have this conversation and listen to you speak and pick some things up here and there. I'm excited for what I'm going to start working on soon.
Awesome. I'm excited for that.
But thank you, man. But don't leave just yet. Let me close out the show. Me and you chat a little bit off the air. And okay. Then... But thank you once again. It was a wonderful show. I greatly appreciate you being here. All right. So now it is time for shout outs. Shout out to my Real Wise fam, Poppy J, Brandy J. Love you guys. Big shout out to my man Dan Lively who came through and left a comment. Thank you, Dan. Big shout out to Ben Souther III from the BS3 Network for stopping by. We air on the BS3 Network every Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 4 p.m. Central Standard Time. Big shout out to the boss lady. Love you and appreciate you, baby. A big shout out to our guest, Jonathan Green, for coming through and really dropping some knowledge on AI. And as always, this actually episode is dedicated to my aunt who passed away this past Saturday from cancer. She was a very special woman. She was a big part of my life. We kind of expected it to happen, but this is dedicated to my aunt Anna. This episode is dedicated to Anna Otero. Love you, Tia, and you're going to be missed greatly. And as always, a big, big shout out to all the essential workers out there. God bless y'all. Be safe. You know how your boy Wise does it. Peace out.